Welcome to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. We continue to celebrate Women's History Month with our first article. Despite loss, Haskell women prove growth. Haskell Indian Nations University, Lady Indians, finished season with a second consecutive Continental Athletic Conference title and NAIA tournament appearance. By Jacob Johnson for ICT News, Indian Country Today. While the scoreboard favored the top-seeded Marion Knights on Friday night for the Haskell Indian Nations University Lady Indians, the final buzzer signified the end of a season defined by grit, growth, and championship DNA. Entering the NAIA National Tournament as a number 16th seed up against a powerhouse host, Haskell faced a daunting task. The 96-67 result sends Marion 30-2 to the second round, but for the Lady Indians, the real story is a program on the rise. Coming off back-to-back Continental Athletic Conference CAC titles, head coach Adam Strom remains steadfast in his pride for his team's journey. It's been a year full of milestones. Even with a loss today, there were 12 winners on the court, and that's the Haskell Fighting Indian Ladies, Coach Strom said after the game. Despite facing a suffocating Marion defense, Haskell refused to abandon their identity. When the Lady Indians broke the initial press, their offensive efficiency shone through. Haskell started off hot from the tip-off, jumping up to a very quick 7-0 lead before Marion responded back with a 25-8 run to end the first quarter. Both teams stayed consistent in the second quarter, and at halftime, Marion led 43-32. Despite only being down 11, the Lady Indians were on their heels. Up to that point, Haskell was leading in field goal percentage and total rebounds. It looked like Haskell had found a rhythm and could pose an upset, but the game was a tale of two halves. Marion completely took over the game in the second half, capitalizing on Haskell's 29 turnovers, which they turned into 42 points. By contrast, Marion only committed 12 turnovers that allowed 11 points on those errors. Marion also doubled Haskell's assistant total, 23-11, and more than doubled their steals, 19-8. Perhaps the most telling stat was the depth of the Knights' roster. Marion's bench outscored Haskell's reserves 42-15, ensuring there was no drop-off in intensity when the starters took a breather. Still, the hustle stats told the story of a Haskell team that never quit, matching the Knights on the glass in stretches and fighting for loose balls until the final whistle. In the end, Haskell outperformed their season averages against Marion's elite length, shooting 45.5% from the field and 35% from the arc. The Fightin' Indians certainly lived up to their name, as Haskell's playmakers consistently found ways to create high-quality looks despite the Knights' relentless defensive pressure. Angela Astorga powered the Haskell offense with a clinical 18-point performance, missing just one shot, 7 of 8, while leading the team with 6 rebounds and 4 steals. Tierza Penn proved why she's a focal point for opposing defenses, scoring 14 points and draining 3 triples. Her savvy navigation of the Knights' closeouts keeping Marion honest. Ona DeFinius added 12 points, 5 rebounds, and was instrumental in transition, providing 3 assists and steadying the offense during Marion's biggest scoring runs. The night was also particularly special for DeFinius, as she surpassed 2,000 career points, and Tierza Penn crossed the 1,000-point mark herself. As the Lady Indians return to Lawrence, Kansas, they do so with their heads held high, with back-to-back CAC banners hanging in the rafters and a core group that now has experienced national tournament pressure. The 2026 season will be remembered as the year Haskell cemented its place as a reoccurring national contender. Looking to the future, Strom knows what it will take for his team to make a third consecutive NAIA National Tournament appearance. Discipline, toughness, and attention to detail are the things we will work on in the offseason to put ourselves in a better position next year, the coach said. Up next, Native American life expectancy increases, but still lowest among U.S. populations, by Elise Wild for Native News Online. New health data released last week showed that life expectancy rates for American Indian and Alaska Natives increased by 4.5 years, the largest increase among racial and ethnic groups, according to a new KFF analysis of mortality rates from 2021 through 2023. American Indian and Alaska Natives, AI and AN, still have the lowest life expectancy of any racial group, at just 70.1 years. That's 8 years less than white people, 78.4, and 15 years less than Asian populations at 85.2, which has the highest life expectancy in the United States. The analysis points to several systemic factors driving the gap, including a lack of access to health care stemming from the chronically underfunded Indian Health Service and higher rates of uninsured Native people. The KFF analysis notes that life expectancy data is available through 2024. The most current demographic breakdown is from 2023. In 1940, according to the National Council of Urban Indian Health, NCUIH, the life expectancy rates for Native people was 51.6 years. It climbed in each of the following decade, reaching 71.8 in 2019. COVID-19 disproportionately affected Indian country, as Native communities saw the high rates of death from the virus. This caused a sharp decline in life expectancy rates that dipped to 65.2 by 2021. Healthier lifestyles and longer lives for Native people has since rebounded. 2024 estimates are signaling a return to pre-COVID-19 levels, according to KFF. Falling rates of COVID-19 were not the only contributors of the increase in life expectancy among Native people, but also declines in chronic liver disease, heart disease, diabetes, and accidents, according to the new data. The leading cause of death in Indian country, and most Americans, is heart disease. The driving factors. Native communities face poorer health outcomes than other populations due to long-standing systemic racism and barriers that restrict access to care. The IHS, which provides health care for millions of Native peoples across Indian country, has never been fully funded. The agency's current budget is $54 billion, short of the recommended amount to fully fund it. For decades, the agency has operated with an average staffing shortage of 25%. In some areas, it has been as high as 46%. Native people are also less likely to be insured than other populations. Research finds that uninsured people face a 40% higher mortality rate than those with coverage. Medicaid is crucial for bridging the gap for Native people who need specialized care beyond what their IHS hospital can provide. Changes to Medicaid work requirements in President Trump's massive spending bill have further strained the agency. Medicaid accounts for 30 to 60% of overall funding at many IHS facilities. In 2025, the IHS billed approximately $1.3 billion to Medicaid. Next, buffalo return. The new herd report shows more than 25,000 buffalo on tribal lands, by Shay Oxendine for Native News Online. The Intertribal Buffalo Council, which represents 89 member nations, has spent decades rebuilding buffalo herds after federal extermination campaigns and land dispossession nearly wiped the animal from tribal homelands. 1,500 buffalo returned to tribes in 2025. The group's 2025 transfers included animals from public, private, and tribal lands to nations such as the Blackfeet Nation, Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, Modoc Nation, Osage Nation, White Earth Nation, and others across the Plains, Midwest, and West. More than 20 tribal nations welcomed more than 1,500 buffalo back to their lands last year as part of a growing national effort to restore the animals to indigenous stewardship, according to the Intertribal Buffalo Council. ITBC coordinated the transfers with support from the Nature Conservancy, the National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Denver Mountain Parks, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and the Wilds in Ohio. The work expanded a tribally managed herd network that now includes more than 25,000 buffalo across 22 states. Buffalo remain central to the spiritual, cultural, ecological, and economic life of Native communities, ITBC Board President Irvin Carlson said. The restoration of buffalo is not only a natural resource effort, but a profound act of cultural healing and tribal sovereignty. The Nature Conservancy provided more than 500 buffalo from preserves in Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Oklahoma. The restoration of buffalo to tribal nations is essential for their communities and for the health of our remaining prairies and grasslands, said Carissa Boos, director of TNC's Buffalo Restoration Program. The ecological benefits of buffalo have become a central part of restoration efforts. Their hooves aerate soil, their droppings feed microorganisms, and their movement spreads native seeds across the prairie. Tribal herd managers have repeatedly pointed to these functions as climate resilience tools, especially as drought and extreme weather reshape grassland ecosystems. ITBC's work also reflects a broader movement among tribes to reclaim food systems and rebuild cultural practices tied to buffalo. In previous reporting, tribal leaders described buffalo herds as anchors for community nutrition programs, youth education, and cultural revitalization. Several nations have used herd growth to expand meat distribution to elders and families, while others have built intertribal partnerships to share animals, training, and infrastructure. That momentum has continued even as tribes navigate uneven federal support. Tribal Business News reporting on the Indian Buffalo Management Act highlighted longstanding concerns about inconsistent funding and the need for stable federal policy. Those concerns remain relevant as tribes look to expand herds in 2026. Best practices from 2025 centered on early season planning, expanded veterinary coordination, and stronger partnerships with conservation groups per the ITBC and Nature Conservancy press release. Several tribes also emphasized the importance of youth and cultural programming to build long-term capacity for herd management and processing, such as at Sacred Storm Buffalo, a combination butchering apprenticeship and clean living program at the Lakota Sioux Reservation in Rapid City, South Dakota. Barriers remain. Many nations face limited land bases, fencing and water infrastructure needs, and the high cost of transporting animals across long distances. Some tribes have also raised concerns about federal grazing regulations that do not always align with the buffalo behavior or cultural priorities. Even with those challenges, ITBC leaders say the growth of tribally managed herds shows what is possible when tribes lead restoration work and federal partners provide consistent support. The organization plans to continue surplus buffalo translocations in 2026, while expanding technical assistance and cultural programming for its member nations. The council described buffalo restoration as a sovereign expression of cultural renew and ecological healing, a process that reconnects communities with a relationship disrupted by federal policy and historical trauma. You're listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. In our next story, Our Culture is Prevention by Elise Wild for Native News Online. Growing up on the Navajo Nation, Deidre Yellowhair heard only whispers of people in her community dying by suicide. In traditional Diné beliefs, speaking about the deceased is thought to beckon more death, and dying by suicide was taboo. In my generation, when I was younger, middle school, high school, suicide wasn't something that was openly talked about, said Yellowhair, an assistant professor and research faculty member in psychiatry and behavioral health at the University of New Mexico. That silence masked a growing crisis. Today, Native youth die by suicide at rates 91% higher than the general population, the highest of any demographic, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's the second leading cause of death for American Indians and Alaska Natives aged 10 to 34. But tribal communities are breaking that silence by turning to culturally centered treatment that blends ceremony, traditional practices, and clinical care. The White Mountain Apache tribe cut its suicide rate by 38% using a model built by tribal elders that makes every resident a mandated reporter and deploys emergency response teams alongside cultural teachings. Today, tribal communities have developed culturally appropriate ways to discuss suicide without violating traditional laws around honoring life, Yellowhair said. I think that the reason we're hearing more about suicide today is that for many of our tribal communities have found culturally appropriate ways to talk about it, without inviting that sense of violating those natural, traditional laws around honoring life and celebrating life, Yellowhair said. Underfunded federal system leaves gaps. An October 2024 study found that Native adolescents have the highest suicide rates of any group, and they may have the least access to resources to help them. The Indian Health Services, the federal agency responsible for providing health care to American Indians and Alaska Natives, is underfunded by tens of billions, and they chronically are understaffed, leaving Native youth without mental health care they are entitled to under treaty rights. From 2000 to 2018, suicide rates climbed steadily across the United States before rising again in recent years. Studies suggest contributing factors, the opioid crisis, dwindling social safety nets, economic downturns, and the rapid expansion of social media use among youth. Several tribal nations are suing social media giants for their roles in harming the mental health of youth in their communities. Private messaging channels on social media or burner accounts can create isolated spaces where bullying thrives, Yellowhair said. I've heard kids come in for therapy sessions talking about what happened on Snapchat or what happened in direct messages on Instagram, Yellowhair said. It's not just public per se, but it happens in these back channel rooms of social media. And kids just don't always have the tools to recognize social media bullying, how to stop or disengage from the content. For Native youth, many bearing generations of historical trauma, social media is an accelerant. Dr. Mark Standing Bear Baez, Coahuiltecan Tribe, is the president of the Society of Indian Psychologists and associate professor of Bemidji State University. Our youth carry the weight of historical harms, Baez told Native News Online. It's looking at how we navigate modern pressures, what is happening on social media, isolation, and even racism. Historical trauma creates intergenerational risk. From 1995 to 1997, more than 17,000 patients in a Southern California healthcare system were surveyed about their childhoods during their annual physical exams. Called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, ACEs for short, it is now the gold standard in linking childhood experiences with health outcomes, both physical and mental. The ACE survey is made up of 10 yes or no questions addressing abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction. Every yes equates to 1 point, resulting in a score along a scale that can tell us someone's risk of developing certain chronic diseases and social, emotional, and mental health disorders. A score of 4 or higher is associated with a higher risk of suicide, and Native youth score 4 or higher more often than any other demographic. In many cases, ACEs are intergenerational. Parents with ACEs have poorer mental health outcomes that result in negative parenting behaviors, creating a cycle that passes on ACEs from generation to generation. The flip side of ACEs are protective factors, social connection, community engagement, and resilient parents, long embedded in Native culture. Extended family and tribal kinship networks were essential, but it's important to note that it also buffers despair, Baez said. The boarding school era violently disrupted those protective factors, removing generations of Native people from their communities and severing kinship networks. The widespread abuse that took place at the boarding schools has been the subject of national investigations. Children were being raised in boarding schools by strangers with no understanding of kinship systems or language or traditions and culture, and really introduced a different type of upbringing and discipline, Baez said. Those parents raised a whole new generation of parents than those parents had children, and you see how it begins to impact generation after generation. That historical trauma, paired with cultural beliefs that often reject the notion of dying by suicide, can make mainstream treatment that may be successful in other communities miss the mark in Indian country. Similar to trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, Yellowhair explained. Professionals have come into communities thinking they have the solution for us, without fully understanding our culture, our ways, why suicide might be so taboo, and it just doesn't work, Yellowhair said. Pushing for Indigenous-centered care. A few years ago, Baez was speaking in Arizona about incorporating Indigenous practices into evidence-based mental health care, and he was surprised to see that a renowned psychiatrist he admired was in the crowd. "I was blown away," Baez told Native News Online. "He's well-known globally, and he liked what I was talking about." But when he had the chance to speak to the psychiatrist, Baez's elation turned to disappointment. Perhaps the issue was less that evidence-based practice needed to be culturally competent for Native people and more that Native people didn't want to heal, the psychiatrist told Baez. He said, "I've been doing this before you were born. I've kind of been around the block. It could be maybe that your people are not ready," Baez recalled. That attitude is exactly what Baez and his peers are trying to change. In 2008, Baez created the Sweetgrass Method, which combines evidence-based practices with Indigenous methodology. "Who loves to sit in pain? Who loves to embrace all of the hardships?" Baez said. "Quite the contrary. We know joy. We know happiness. We know the importance of healing. But maybe it's just the way it's being delivered." Reconnecting culture and prevention. Shelby Rowe Chickasaw spent her early adolescence in a school in Oklahoma with a large Native population. Her mother was a weaver who took her to events where she reveled in being surrounded by Native artists and their wares. She was a good student, involved in school, and communicated openly with her family. But when she was 15, something shifted. Rowe was staying with her great-grandmother when the matriarch went into heart failure. It was the middle of the night in rural Oklahoma, and the volunteer ambulance in the area didn't run from midnight to 5 a.m., so Rowe called neighbors to bring them to Seminole, the nearest town with a hospital. That night, her great-grandmother died. In her grief, Rowe felt crushed by guilt that she didn't act fast enough, that her great-grandmother's death was somehow her fault. While her family mourned their loss, Rowe hid her suffering. "We joke in tribal communities about being stoic," Rowe said, "but sometimes the feelings are so deep, you just don't have the capacity to process them." One night, Rowe made a plan to end her life. "I was so overwhelmed with depression and grief and guilt," Rowe said. I was like, well, I don't know how to fix this. I don't know how to make this pain end. So I'm going to take my life. At the root, I wanted help more than I wanted to die. While Ro did not act on her plan, untreated depression and guilt festered in her. By the time she was 19, she had two young children and had lost her husband to an accidental shooting. In the following years, she grappled with suicidal ideation and survived one suicide attempt. She emphasizes that not getting treatment as a teenager led to those challenges that persisted into her adulthood. I was still alive, she said, but I developed self-destructive habits and just had no self-worth. Today, Ro is the program manager for the Suicide Prevention Resource Center at the OU Health Science Center and serves on several boards focused on supporting mental health services in Native communities. I think we're getting better, and there are so many incredible programs happening across Indian country right now to help save lives, Ro said, noting that equipping tribes with the tools they need is more sustainable than the federal government swooping in to save the day. Ro points to the Celebrating Life Suicide Prevention Model, established by the White Mountain Apache Tribe in 2002 after a spike in youth suicides. The model uses sovereignty via tribal law that designates all people living on the tribe's Fort Apache Indian Reservation in Arizona as mandated reporters, meaning any individual who recognizes suicidal behaviors and substance abuse must report it to the tribe's suicide task force. The task force follows up with emergency response and individual case management. I think a lot of that success is when you are struggling and feeling that you don't belong, you're feeling hopelessness and despair. Having other people in your community show up and say, hey, we care about you. We're not going to give up on you. That connection is huge, Ro said. The science backs that up. A 2025 study that surveyed 197 Native youth to examine protective and risk factors showed that communities with cultural programming that facilitated strong familial and social connections were likely to see lower rates of suicide. Working with youth, ceremony, prayer, smudging, they're not add-ons. They're core systems of care. It's medicine, Baez explained. Our culture is prevention. Years ago, Baez was contracted by the Bureau of Indian Education to work at a tribal school struggling with behavioral issues among its students. The community endured several suicides during his tenure. Most of the faculty were non-Native, Baez said, and the absence of culture was apparent. In the fall, the school board asked Baez to help the students put on a summer solstice ceremony. The tribal council enthusiastically approved the idea, and the youth were excited to perform. But there was a major challenge. No one knew the dances, no one had the regalia, and no one knew the traditional songs. But someone did know, the elders knew, Baez said. A lot of the elders felt that no one needed them anymore. I wanted our elders to know that you are sacred, and you hold our knowledge, and I wanted our children to know how much power and knowledge and how many paved roads the elders created for them. Over the course of months, elders in the community worked with the youth to make the regalia, build instruments, learn songs and dances and language. By spring, the entire community showed up for the ceremony where their songs and dances filled the air for the first time in decades. I took a step back and I just looked at what was happening, Baez said, and it was bigger than a performance. There was a healing that took place that day. I'll never forget it. Even months after, the students kept saying, when are we going to do this again? You've been listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Land Back by Hallucination. You can always hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device if you miss a program. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.